Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John. I am your host, Big John, and today we have a very special guest to talk about issues involving libertarianism, political activism, and just in general, I guess, being a good person in society. I just want to make sure that I have my guest's bio correct, because I don't want to shortchange him. So I'm going to look down slightly while I read his bio, but please give us your full attention if you don't mind. Okay, my guest today is a prominent libertarian activist, writer, and podcast host, best known for his multifaceted work in promoting individual liberty and challenging government overreach, something every libertarian can get behind. As the president of Agenda Setters by Downsize DC and executive editor of the Advocates for Self-Government, he has been instrumental in crafting legislative initiatives like the Read the Bills Act, something not enough congressmen do, and the One Subject at a Time Act. He's the former press secretary for Libertarian presidential candidate Harry Brown and co-creator of the Zero Aggression Project. My guest continues to be a significant voice in libertarian activism as he hosts the podcast Graysarchy with Jim Bobka. And he's also serving on the board such as the Free Speech, Legal Defense, and Education Fund and the People for Liberty. Everyone, please welcome my guest, Jim Bobka. Jim, how are you today?
I'm excellent. Thanks, John, for having me.
I really appreciate you. I know you're a busy man. I really appreciate you coming on. So let's start at the beginning. Tell me, where were you born? Where were you raised? What kind of beginnings does Jim Bobka have?
Okay, well, I just want to make one tiny thing. My last name's pronounced Babka.
Babka, I apologize. Babka,
no problem. Babka. No problem. Because I see other people do that too, so don't. It's not a big deal. I'm from Northeast Ohio. I was born and raised, born in Cleveland and raised in Northeast Ohio.
Okay. So Midwestern sensibilities, would you say?
Oh, definitely. I'm to the core. There's something kind of about kind of a Rust Belt, they used to call it, mentality. And I'm very much a product of that environment.
And for those that may not be as familiar with it, how would you describe that environment, that mentality? You kind of said Rust Belt to the core. So can you sort of give us some highlights of what that might be?
Yes. Basically culturally conservative, believing in hard work as a pathway to success, and expecting that life's going to give you bumps and bruises along the way, that you're going to lose more often than you win. So there's a perseverance or a grit that comes from that.
Right. So would it be fair to say it's what we used to describe back when I was a child, at least, as the Protestant work ethic? Is that
yeah, I would say applicable? It's adjacent to that. I don't know how much. I mean, Protestant was definitely part of my upbringing, but it wasn't. I just in trying to describe kind of like how I understand the people that I live with and grew up around. You know, our parents, you know, were hardworking people. We had a mix of white and blue collar in my upbringing. It was a healthy mix of those two things. My father was in the white collar side of it, but you know, I had to stay home. The other parents stayed home. You know, that was a very traditional family structure. And you know, Ohioans kind of have this mentality, particularly the ones up north and towards Cleveland, that it's, you know, kind of us against the world, right? Mm-hmm. And when I'm old enough now that I can remember when Cleveland was called the mistake by the lake, and there was kind of this mentality that we were kind of the, you know, we should almost be embarrassed that we were from here. But I'm not. I mean, I'm actually pretty proud of where I come from, and I think it represents things like, and I know a lot of people would say hard work. I mean, I think that's probably true of a lot of places, but there's a particular grit growing up in an area that was once very industrial and became deindustrialized, and has had to learn how to adapt and improvise and overcome.
Yeah, and I think it's something that I've run, that sort of mentality, that sort of mindset is something you definitely run across people from a certain generation that came from places like Cleveland, Pittsburgh, maybe Cincinnati, you know, that area in the middle of the country, that you could certainly see the same strain in a lot of folks, meaning, you know, the same, and again, that's not meant to be disparaging, because I could say the same thing about New Yorkers. I'm a native New Yorker. from a certain generation. So, like, you know, we're acerbic. We like things fast. You know, that's not an overstatement. It's just the way the environment in which we were raised was. So,
yeah, and so pace-wise, like, you know, I would say that the South, is my anticipation is that they're very polite and congenial and move at a certain pace.
Right.
And then there are other places that move at an incredibly fast pace. These are the major cities in the country, like, you know, San Francisco and New York and D.C. There's this pace. And we lived in D.C. for 4 years, or the D.C. area. So I'm familiar with that pace and found it too fast, too congested, too busy. And, you know, in a place like here, you know, now that you've got me thinking about it, everybody's from here. There's very few people that migrated here. There are people that leave, but there's very few people that, like, come here. You know, when I spent the time I spent in D.C., hardly anybody was from there. They were from somewhere else. And often were only there for a period of time. They would often go somewhere else next or even back home. And so this is a place that people are from.
Right. So you're still living in Ohio?
I moved back. We had a gap. You mentioned that I was working with Harry Brown, and that's what made me move. And then I stayed for a few years longer. And then when we had the opportunity, we came back because this is where the family was.
Right, right. And that certainly makes sense. You know, it's interesting. If I'm not mistaken, I think the comedian Dave Chappelle said something similar. Like, they keep asking, why do you live in Ohio, of all places? Someone given your fame and fortune, why are you living in Ohio? And he said, because it's real here.
Yeah, it's just very normal.
It's very normal. It's very real. And he's saying it keeps him grounded.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so my career has enabled me to do a whole bunch of things with people all across the country. And it has enabled me to meet many famous people such that it's kind of, for the most part, mundane to me. Like, people are people. Whereas most of the people that I live with or amongst and that I've spent my time with, this would be an exceptional experience for them. They have stories that they're very excited about. I met this person, that person. For me, it's like almost like name dropping, because it's just like I've had the pleasure of being able to travel around and see the people and meet the people and interact with the people that I've seen in politics and television and even entertainment to some degree. And so, it is just it's a normal place made up of really normal people with normal concerns and normal values.
Yeah. And obviously that helps, especially if you get involved in politics, which we'll get into in a little bit.
Yeah. And we have no accent here too, either, by the way.
Yeah. See,
everywhere else does.
By the way, I have to say that when I was working in biotech, one of the things that I helped develop was a system where, hospitals and doctors could call in, you know, they send in their sample to be cultured. And then rather than have a person spend time to read it out, it would all be automated. Mm-hmm. So when we were recording the species names for the bacteria or the viruses that we found, that the machine would find, my directive was the voice has to be Midwestern.
Interesting.
It has to be like that middle of the country. And when I would say why, they'd say, because John, you don't understand. You have a New York accent.
Yes.
So now we don't hear it. Like, I hear the difference between Brooklyn, Bronx, and Manhattan accents or Staten Island accents, but they're all New Yorkers.
Yes.
But it's interesting that you brought that up as well. Like, like, we don't sound like anybody in here in Ohio. We don't. So just to validate your point, Jim.
That's awesome. That story is going to be told again. What you just said to me, I'm going to find ways to repeat that.
Feel free. Please work it in.
Thank you, John.
Okay. All right. So you're growing up in this hard-working sort of area. You mentioned your father was a white-collar worker. Do you mind, what kind of work was he involved
in? Yeah, he was an executive. He was in charge of the purchasing department at a aftermarket auto parts maker that did mainly brake lines and power steering. So, Detroit and Cleveland are kind of this line. Everybody knows that Detroit is auto, but Cleveland was also very heavily auto, and Akron to the south of it initially was rubber, which is where the tires and stuff were being made. So there was kind of this belt there that ran along where there was a lot of auto industry stuff. And so my dad made his living for over 35 years working in the aftermarket auto parts industry. Oh. And 31 of those years were with one particular company. That's the company he was at right before I was born, and it was the one he was at after I moved out of the house.
Yeah, which is something that's also lost today, right? The idea that you might be with an employer for 30 years.
Yeah, and that definitely impacted my values. My father really wanted me to go to college, He had only, you know, had about equivalent of nearly a year of college that he had done in night school. He had managed to be successful without that degree, but wasn't sure that I was going to be able to do it. And, you know, there was an expectation. It's also on my wife's side of the family. Her father is a United Auto Worker union member. You know, there was this expectation that you were going to get a job and you were going to work your way up and stay at that company. So that was largely, that's a big chunk of how I was raised as well.
Yeah. And which is in contrast with today, right? Because if you enter the corporate world today and you see on someone's resume, for example, that they've been at the same spot for 5 years, you start to wonder, is something wrong with them? Are they not ambitious? Do they not want to move up the ladder? Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming you're Gen X like myself, that perhaps, you know, this is something that we have had the opportunity to experience within the span of our, say, career lifetimes, this move away from loyalty, staying at one place. And by loyalty, I mean in both directions, not certainly not mm-hmm. the employee to the employer unilaterally, but in both directions. Whereas now people are expected to hustle, to go from spot to spot, to pick up as much experience as possible. If you compare the two, do you feel there's a particular advantage to one or the other? Or do you feel there's, or take it from the opposite direction, is there a disadvantage to one or the other?
No, I think it's better that, I think most people are going to disagree with me on this, but I think it's actually better now. The idea that you stay at one place and do just one thing for a very, very long time, maybe that's comfortable. And I do think there was a degree that there was an expectation in the past that there would be comfort right. in what your occupation was. But I think the ability to stretch yourself and keep doing better things does require or necessitate some change. And what I've noticed is that even in my own work, I was primarily self-employed from 2001 to 2019. So I had to, you know, figure out how to, you know, meet a payroll, handle a profit and loss statement, fundraise and do the work I wanted to do on top of that. And that was, you know, you kind of feel like you've peaked at that point, but I was able to slide into a more corporate situation. Now the work that I'm doing, I'm involved in a group and I'm on a variety of different projects where I'm consulting, but you know, I'm getting a salary now. Right. It's a way different thing. If that wasn't constantly shifting, if there wasn't constant demand on me to learn and do new things, because the stuff I started doing 6 years ago when I switched roles versus what I'm doing now it's just different. And so I think that's actually good for you as a human being to have these new challenges and to stretch and grow and learn. And I also think it means you have more opportunity. You have you're not going to get sediment into one place and not be able to change your circumstance. There's going to be, maybe, I don't know, I'm too young to understand whether this was true, but maybe if you moved a lot back then, it would have been considered odd. Now you can. You have the freedom to be like, if this isn't working for me, I can go do something better. Or even if it's good, I can still reach for something better. I like it better now, I think.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because certainly part of my career was spent in banking, was spent on Wall Street as well. And I could definitely tell you that as a hiring manager, if you get a resume where you saw someone go from place to place, say in less than 2 years, there used to be this rule headhunters used to have, which was no matter what, try to stick it out for 3-4 years, no matter where you are. Because if you start moving around too much, people will think you're flaky. They'll think you're undependable.
Yeah.
So whereas now it's the exact opposite. Like they may think you're just someone who just wants to be in that cruise mode for the rest of your career. So they view you're staying in one place. And so by staying in one place, maybe we should say staying in the same position for too long. Like certainly if you work for a big enough company, you could take various roles.
You should just keep moving. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
there should be some evolution or progress in who you are and what your talents are. My interests aren't even the same as they were, you know, 10 years ago. Like there's this constant shift inside me. I can't imagine standing still. It would be hard.
I tend to agree with you. Okay. So growing up in Ohio, at some point you went to school. I'm trying to look in my notes. Was it the University of?
Yeah, I went to the University of Akron.
University of Akron, where you got a degree in political science, correct?
Well, I didn't quite finish. I left as a senior.
Okay.
Which is an odd thing to do, I realize. I don't want to make it sound like, oh, he was, you know, because I was a sixth-year senior. I had never really – I was supposed to be in school full-time, but I wasn't quite full-time. And I had a couple classes, one in particular that really stumped me, that I was going to have to go back and deal with. And I was still going to need to be there probably another year and a half to finish.
Wow.
And I just didn't want to anymore. I didn't really enjoy it. I didn't like it. I was more interested in my extracurricular activities. And I don't mean this in a negative way. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't partying. But I was working darn near full time. Right. I made more money than most of my friends. I was one of the first to get a car. I was ambitious already. And my ambitions weren't being met as fast as I wanted. So I started trying to experiment with starting my own businesses.
Yeah.
And so I just decided to step out and really pursue those business opportunities.
Yeah. Now, when you say you were a 6-year senior, was that because you were trying to go through because you had full-time work, like you said, and it was tough getting through? Or was it for academic reasons? Was it that you kept changing your major? My first guess might have been, oh, he's Van Wildering it. He's doing like a Bert Kreischer, 7-8 years in college. Yeah. But you're saying, no, that wasn't it. It wasn't because of partying. It wasn't because you were
out. No, I've never actually been drunk in my life. So yeah.
Well, thank
not
you.
Once.
Well, so, welcome to the club.
Thank you. And there's not many of us. I mean, most people have had at least one such experience. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that makes me special, but it means that that wasn't really my way.
Right.
You know, I had some friends that were going to start a band, and I was helping manage the band. And I was working for a Fortune 500 company in their stores division. And I was in high demand. They had a lot of stores, and they would float me around because they could put me wherever they needed to drop me. And I could adapt to wherever I was. And I was, you know, pretty reliable that way. And I brought extra talents even to that situation. I was able to do some things that other people didn't know how to do. I actually left a permanent mark on this company. There was something I innovated that ended up getting adopted at headquarters and spread throughout the entire company. I started two separate businesses on top of all of that. And so, and then I was running on campus, I was running an independent student newspaper. So I was responsible for the fundraising. Year one, I was the editor in chief. And year two, I had managed to hand off some of the business functions and some of the editing functions to other people. I was still writing for it and still making sure it was laid out and distributed. But I was doing that as well. So, you know, there's a lot going on in that period of my life. And, you know, school came after all of that.
Right, right. No, I got you. Definitely. I mean, I can definitely see that because and as you're talking, I find a lot of similarities between our upbringings, Jim. Like you mentioned your dad's job. My father was actually an auto mechanic. So there's some tie in there. And then I also had to work full time through my college experience as well, which I
see. I didn't have to. It wasn't like a compelled thing. My father was actually I revealed this in a recent podcast. He was actually helping significantly with, paying, you know, 90% of the bill. And okay. And I was really blessed that he was doing that. Now, college tuition back then was all a whole lot less than it is today.
Agreed.
And I was going to a state university that I was commuting to. So that kept the cost, you know, significantly down, and I would buy my books and sell them back. Right. So, you know, I had, but I just wanted to work. Like I wanted the money and I wanted to advance it, whatever it was, everywhere I was, I wanted to move up. Everything I was doing, I wanted to lead.
Very entrepreneurial. It sounds.
Yeah. And you know, the problem with class is they tell you what you have to think about, what you have to care about, what you have to regurgitate. Somebody else is telling me what I have to think. And I just, there's something kind of internal to me that said that I don't want to do that, you know.
And it must have had an impact on you for your future life, because I read somewhere that you decided to homeschool your children instead of sending them off
to
school.
And in fact, we even ran into a family that was doing something called unschooling. Mm. And when they told us about the tremendous results they got, we had three children. We recognized that two of them would be really good candidates for that. The other would not. And so we had 2 years where we had virtually no curriculum.
Right. And I think I have interviewed two proponents of the unschooling and unlearning methodologies.
Yeah. We only did it for 2 years. It was an elementary school phase. Two of my three children started college after their sophomore year of high school. One of them started when he left, but didn't stay. He ended up wanting a different, he wanted a trade, and right. He's gone into a specific area. So,
yeah. So clearly, and I'm assuming you feel you made the right choice, right?
Yeah. I wished that it had been available to me. So, you know, I believe that everyone has kind of a natural shape to them. You come out a certain way. There's certain traits and attributes that all three of my kids have had from the beginning that they still have to this day, even though they're all in their late 20s now. Right. And I think one of the things you try to do as a parent is help shape or guide them to maximize those abilities a little bit. And I would have liked to have been in a situation where instead of having to conform to what was going on, and that's another part of the Northeast Ohio mentality, is very conformist.
Right.
There is a normal way to do things, and I am an outlier. And so I frequently felt at odds with things that were going on around me. I just like, why does it, I'm the guy that would always ask, why does it have to be this way? And there's a bit of an idealist or justice streak in me. And so, you know, that got me in trouble. Like, people don't like that. They don't like to be told that they're, what they're doing makes no sense at the moment. And, you know, I learned that the hard way.
Well, I was going to say, it is disruptive. I mean,
yeah.
Without assigning it a value judgment, you know, good, bad, or neutral, it is disruptive. People don't like change for the most part. And not that I blame a lot of them. You know, and a lot of people are not, to your point, they're not shaped, they're not wired for change. So, you know, they like the, I don't want to say they like the conformity, but they like the predictability. They like,
yeah. And I, you know, I'm almost jealous of these people. I mean, cause the world is the way it is. You know, you come into this world, it causes agitation inside you to feel this way.
Right.
Like you wish things were different. I just wish I could just be like, oh, well, that's the way it is, and go along with it. I know people, right. You know, you can kind of call them, what did Tony Soprano call them? The happy wanderer, right? There's a little bit of jealousy of that. Like, why is it that I don't feel I fit into that thing? And I'm sure they have their moments where they feel exactly the same way too, but it's just certain things, you know, I tend to evidence that I'm not happy about certain things around me or the situation a little more than I notice other people doing the same thing. And I also noticed that it got me in trouble. I mean, I was told repeatedly that, you know, I was causing trouble, or I wasn't a team player, or, you know, that kind of thing. That makes me partially an entrepreneur. Like, there's a certain point at which I'm like, well, I'll just do this the way I think it should be done.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I feel like a ping pong ball, because I sort of go between the two extremes, right? There's times where nothing appeals to me about conformity. And then there's other times where I'm like, no, this is the way to do it. Let's not waste too much time arguing about it. And I remember as a child purposely giving wrong answers to the teacher when called upon. Like, it's a distinct memory of mine in grade school where they would say, hey, John, how does this work? And, you know, as part of a homework answer, and I'd give them the wrong answer on purpose, but one that sounded feasible, that sounded plausible.
Interesting.
Because I wanted the teacher to explain more to me. I didn't want to just regurgitate. So I remember, like, my parents being brought in and saying, this guy, your son is causing way too much trouble in class. We don't have time to lecture him for an hour and leave everybody else on it. You know, and that was, I don't know if that was me just being devilish or actually, to your point, just trying to understand how everything works around me. Having said that, now let's veer a little bit slightly. You're as a teenager, as a young man, a young adult, you're working, you're interested in entrepreneurship. You kind of feel like you got to learn more about your world and everything. Talk to me how you transitioned into politics as a way of scratching that itch, because a lot of, like, especially today's generation might say, well, why didn't he become like a tech entrepreneur? Why didn't he go start some sort of financial business where he's, you know, making money hand over fist, you know, or whatever, or become a day trader, whatever. You chose politics. Talk to me a little bit about, did you always have an interest in politics, or is that something that you gained an affinity for as you got older?
So it's an in again, it's an in, then an out, and then a back in again situation. That's how this, the story basically goes. In seventh grade, I had a teacher who did something politically incorrect. Every time the test was turned back over to the class, he announced who got the highest score. I was not a stellar student. I wasn't deeply interested in most of the stuff that was going on. But my ears perked up when routinely I was one of two and sometimes three students whom I can still name from seventh grade when Mr. Betts would hand back our social studies tests. And, you know, which encompasses history and so right. on. And in ninth grade, when we took the national aptitude tests, I scored in the 99th percentile on the social studies portion of it. So by that point, it was beginning to dawn on me that this was where my aptitudes and interests lie. And I started, my father, it was a favorite parlor trick of his to have his friends ask me what I was going to be when I grew up at that point. And I'd say, oh, I'm going to be a United States Senator. And they would laugh heartily. And they'd be like, well, you're awfully ambitious, but, you know, why not president since you're going to Senator? I'm like, have you seen how much those guys age when they're in office? I don't want that job. And they would laugh again.
Right.
And I specifically took the ACT instead of the SAT because there was a social studies component in it. And I could drive my score up. And I successfully did on that portion of it. I liked history. I liked politics. I liked civics. I liked psychology. I liked everything that was kind of in that area. It all kind of interested me. And so I went to the University of Akron to study political science. And I ended up, I come from, my father was a Goldwater Republican. He voted for Reagan. I am just late enough that I cannot vote for Reagan. But I am able to participate in the 1998 election for George Herbert Walker Bush. And he wasn't my first choice running. I was a big fan. I'm a geeky kid. I liked Jack Kemp, who was a congressman from Buffalo, New York, a former NFL quarterback, or actually AFL, to be precise.
For the Bills, yeah.
Yep.
And what's interesting is, just to interrupt you for a second, I met Jack Kemp once. Great guy.
I did too.
Yeah, great guy. But if you ever got him talking about economics, he could put anyone to sleep with his detail and mastery.
Which is why he didn't make a very good presidential candidate in 1988.
Exactly. Yes,
that was one of the reasons. There were a couple, and that was one of them.
Yes.
And but very congenial, very, you know, he very much was a politician. He was a backslapper, you know, a gladiator. And but I still admired what he was doing and who he was and how he carried himself. And that was my interest. And I got involved in the College Republicans, and I will skip all the gory details. But there was a couple of things that happened during my time there that were just completely turned my head and made me realize that people are attracted to the larceny. They want to be who they be, who politicians become. There is an attraction principle at work. So a lot of people believe in Lord Acton's theory that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. If by some chance somebody good gets through the system, that's the law to apply to them. But most of the time, I'm just going to be perfectly blunt here, the people attracted into this are willing to commit crimes. The people that start off, this is what they're doing. They're running for student government like I did. They're doing this, that, and the other. They have bad intent. Like, they like the power. And right. So there were some things that happened that were really bad. And I experienced these things kind of they caused ethical trauma within me. And I started to back up from what I was doing. Now, I ended up through a series of events, taking over a paper that was 1 year old. It was part of a network of student newspapers at the time called the Collegiate Network. Peter Thiel was in that network at the same time I was. We produced a newspaper. We rebranded, renamed it, reissued it. I did that for 2 more years. But I was losing interest in college as this was happening, and I was already getting into business. And real estate is where I thought I was going to make my biggest splash. I had two different businesses. One of them, I was a real estate investor, and that's where I thought I was going to go. But it turns out I never really had a strong aptitude for this stuff. And it wasn't because I couldn't do it. It was because it didn't interest me as much, anywhere near as much as all this social study stuff. So you kind of have to have some passion or something that rouses you. And that would show up. I was much more motivated in that setting than it turned out I was for just making a living, just showing up and doing the job. The motivation wasn't anywhere near as high. I wasn't as creative. I wasn't as sharp. I wasn't as energetic at those things. And it wasn't that I couldn't do it. Like I said, it's just that the energy, the passion wasn't quite there. And I started to drift back after the Republicans took over the House for the first time in 40 years in 1994. I sat in a living room for what was to become the congressional candidate that was going to run in my district. And she was a sacrificial lamb. She wasn't going to win. There were 25 or 30 people in that room that night, and none of them knew me. Mm-hmm. By the end of that night, they all did. And I wasn't trying to be the center of attention. I didn't even speak initially. I knew something that nobody else knew, and before long, I'm getting called on. Like, there's almost a conversation between the campaign manager, the daughter of and son of the candidate themselves, and me, going on in front of a room in front of 30 people. And this was the beginning of a dawning on me that I had something, that I knew how to do stuff once again that other people didn't know how to do. It just came to me. Like, it was just there. I didn't end up getting hired by that campaign, and it frustrated me. And then even more frustrating was that the Republicans nominated Bob Dole. And I thought that was the time was snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Right.
And then I discovered Harry Brown. I discovered the Libertarian Party and Harry Brown in July of 1996. And that changed my life.
Now, when you say you discovered Harry Brown, when you discovered the Libertarian Party, are you saying philosophically you were always, now you mentioned like your dad was a Goldwater Republican, which my father was as well. And while Goldwater, I wouldn't categorize him as a libertarian, he was probably libertarian adjacent, especially for the times, right?
Yeah, for the time you would have called him a libertarian, but maybe proto-libertarian would be a better term, right?
Right, yeah. So did you always kind of have these libertarian leanings or formulations that you just assumed were a better fit for the Republican Party? Or was it after you kind of got involved with Republicans, I'm assuming Republicans, and you kind of mentioned these incidents that kind of turned you off to them, you know, Lord Acton came to mind. And then you're like, okay, but I'm still interested here. Is there another home for me? Is that how you kind of migrated? Or was it like reading a particular article, whether it was in Reason or somewhere else? I mean, how did you get initially drawn to the Libertarian Party or libertarianism?
Okay, to start off with the philosophical part of your conversations, the answer is yes, but mostly no. The yes part of it is that I was always oriented towards believing the Republicans meant that when they said they wanted smaller government. Okay. They never did. Okay. And that hypocrisy was fundamental to me. And I didn't buy into that part of it. And I thought it was a huge deal that they never were willing to, they were willing to, they were like what we would have called at the time 1-900 phone sex, right? They got you all hot and bothered. They even convinced you they were going to come over, but at the end of the day, they left you hanging.
They
right?
Never did, right.
And so that part of me was, so there's an openness that direction. But on questions like foreign policy, value questions, no, I really was not. I was disappointed with what was happening after the Contract with America. I was very excited at the beginning of the process, but 2 years later, when it was obvious that they were trying to drive everybody into Bob Dole, who was, you know, lame, you know, mainstream, not part of that movement, had been critical of that movement, and all of a sudden they're all lining up behind him. I couldn't do it. It felt wrong.
Right. And for folks that may, I'm sorry, for folks that may not remember, Contract with America was Newt Gingrich's.
It was his 1994 bargain with the voters that if you give us the majority, we will put bills on the floor and vote on the following things.
And they actually listed them out. They said, I forget how many there were on the list, maybe 10 or 12 or whatever. But they said, here's our contract with you guys, America. And this was Newt Gingrich, who at the time was very much a firebrand, getting rid of Jim Wright, who was an entrenched...
The Republicans had been out of power for 40 consecutive years.
In the House.
Right? Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
So this was a big deal when this happened.
But it was before, a big deal. Yeah.
Before all that happened, I was a Rush Limbaugh ditto head. So I was buying the whole package of what they were selling. They weren't delivering on all of it, but I was buying all of it.
Right.
I realized this happens in June or July of 1996. In June, I realized I can't vote for Bob Dole. And I call some of my closest friends that I would talk to about these kinds of issues. And they would say things to me like, well, you're going to elect Bill Clinton. And I said, well, I don't think I've got that much power,
right.
But that's not my problem. I'm not going to, you know, there's not enough difference between these two men, frankly. It just isn't justified. One's going to grow the government at this rate. The other one's going to grow it a little more. I mean, it just, like, I can't go to the barricade for that. And then on top of that, then I had a friend who was a libertarian who had tried to get me interested in the party. So what ended up happening was I came in, I was a real estate agent by this point, I'm a realtor, and I would come in between appointments to my house, and my TV was right by the front door, and I'd walk by and I'd turn it on and I would start doing the other things I needed to do and maybe sit down and grab a bite or, you know, do paperwork or whatever, right, with the TV on. And I turned on C-SPAN and the Libertarian Party convention was on and I stayed there. And I saw some people speak and I was immediately attracted. Joe Sobran was one of them. James Bavard was another. There's a third person that I can no longer remember that I watched that first day. And then I saw Harry Brown debate. He was the eventual nominee. And then I saw him give his acceptance speech. And then on the morning after, he was on Brian Lamb's Washington Journal. And my conversion moment happens during that show. And he answers a question that it was particularly vexing to me about why I shouldn't be libertarian. And when he answered that question the way that he answered it, a light bulb went off over my head. I'm like, I got it. And it still took some more time before I would say I became fully libertarian, but I was definitely interested in Harry and not very long thereafter involved in the Libertarian Party.
Yeah. And it's interesting how people will say how they came to libertarianism. A lot of them do describe it almost like a religious experience. Like, yeah, I had these questions and up until now they weren't answered, and then they were, and it just kind of hit me like a thunderbolt, you know? So I kind of relate to what you just described there. Okay. So how did you go about getting involved though, directly with the Brown campaign?
Well, that happens in stages. I go to a Harry Brown event and I'm introduced to the chair of the state party. His name was Jack. And Jack, I was there with two friends, one of whom was the libertarian I mentioned a moment ago. Mm-hmm. And Jack, I we tell Jack about a plan to maybe bring the vice presidential candidate. We were in Cleveland, we bring her to Akron, you know, and he's like, don't bother. He said, no, the media won't pay any attention. No one's going to pay attention to the vice presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party. In your area, we don't have an organized group. What we really need is somebody to organize it. So why don't you get started on that? And I got back in the car, John, and I'm driving home and I'm giving my friend an earful. It's like, I could be Jeffrey Dahmer as far as this guy knows. Like, right. I could be anything. Like, I'm driving down the road and I'm just excoriating him. I'm like, how in the world can he ask me to take a leadership role in something I'm not even a member of yet? And I just was so appalled. And I called him that night and I called him again the next day. We talked a lot and I called him and said, I can't believe that he even asked me that. And then a couple days later, I said, but if I were going to do it,
okay.
And very shortly after, he and I did, we set up a local county chapter that covered two of the counties. There's 88 counties in Ohio. Our chapter was responsible for, people would recognize the names Akron. And then next door, they would recognize the name Kent, Kent, where Kent State is. Right. Our chapter covered that area. And we needed 10 people to start our chapter. We had 11 and we went from there. We grew it, and I got involved in the state committee. I became state fundraising director, and then I got elected chair. Jack ended up endorsing me for chair. I got elected chair in 1998. So while I'm doing all the things that I'm doing there, the guy who would be Harry Brown ran twice, and the guy who was managing his 2000 campaign, I had struck up a friendship with him. I very much admired what he was doing and how he was doing it. It was the most successful period in the history of the Libertarian Party in terms of growth, budget, membership, that type of thing. Still hasn't been matched. And I very much was an admirer of what he was doing. And I was beginning to associate with the same people he associated with. And he was watching me very closely. And I reached a point in 1999 where I was really kind of tired of the real estate and some other stuff that was going on. And I said, I really wish I could work on this full time. And he said, would you like to come to work for the Harry Brown campaign? And he hired me for a position I was completely unqualified for, which was press secretary. And when I started, I didn't know what to do and I did it badly, but I learned and he knew I would. And I've been full time at some libertarian adjacent activity ever since.
Well, that's really a great story. And I think it's inspiring for the younger people who want to get involved and who want to get involved, not necessarily because they want to get involved in politics, but want to see a change.
All right. Well, let me share with them, if you have any that are listening, two pieces of advice. The first piece of advice is don't give advice where you haven't been asked for it. which I just broke.
Okay.
And I can say it now because I'm an old man. But if you're young and you're trying to come up and you're trying to get started, when I went to Perry's office as national director for the very first time, I was the only person, he reports this to me, I was the only Libertarian Party member that ever visited his office that never once said, you ought to do this, you ought to do that. I never once gave him any advice. The whole time I was there, I asked question after question after question about what he was doing, how he was doing it, why he was doing it, what he expected to happen from it. Right. I asked question after question. And I can tell you things about that day to this very hour. It's vivid in my mind because I was really curious about what was going on there. And then, number two, I went home and did some of the things he recommended. I followed through. He was watching then to see, does this guy actually do? Is he just here? Is he just posturing? Who is he?
Right.
When I went back home, I actually started doing the things. And he noticed this. So the fact that I asked questions and didn't give advice, the fact that I went back and I actually did the work, those are the two things that actually opened the door for me.
Yeah, and that's great advice, not just in politics, I think, but in general. That I mean, I think it's equally applicable in business, whether you're in a small business or a big company, especially in a bigger company. You know, there's always this, especially if you're the new person in the organization, whatever the organization is, you almost have a sense of, man, I want to prove my worth. I want to let them know that I'm on the ball. So, yeah, a lot of times you'll offer up unsolicited advice, or you think you have a better way of doing things, and perhaps you may not be aware that it's already been tried.
It's already been
tried.
There's
a reason it's not being done, right?
Right.
Which in some ways I think is applicable to today's Libertarian Party, but we can avoid that conversation for now. All right, Jim. So just to move on a little bit. Okay. So you got your initial, you dipped your toes in the Libertarian pool with Harry Brown's campaigns. You also worked as a paid consultant for Bill Redpath's gubernatorial campaign mm-hmm. in Virginia. But really, a lot of the things that some folks may know you about is that you were the president of Real Campaign Reform, which was set up to oppose McCain-Feingold. Talk to me a little bit about that.
So I you've done your homework. During the Brown campaign, we had anticipated, we as a team had anticipated and sat down with attorneys to begin designing a plan to attack the entire federal electoral structure, because there were things like the Democrats and Republicans get their conventions paid for by taxpayers. There was presidential matching funds that are given to these candidates that help elevate and boost them, which we opposed on principle. The mere existence of this thing, but let alone, you know, we recognize it also put us at a disadvantage. There were ballot access laws. There were campaign finance restrictions, which hit challengers and benefit incumbents, their incumbent protection acts, essentially.
Right.
And so we began investigating a legal strategy to take on many of these kinds of things. The Presidential Debate Commission was also a violation, in our opinion, of some of the very laws they had set up to suppress us. So, you know, we looked at this whole picture and we wanted to do something about it. When the campaign, we weren't able to really do that and a campaign at the same time. But when the campaign ended, McCain-Feingold, which was a campaign finance law, became the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, was actively being debated. And this was a little bit of a Potemkin village that had been built with the help of elevating John McCain in the media. The media recognized that it was a good thing that there were these restrictions on candidates too, because it allowed them to control more of the traffic or flow about what information you received about a candidate. A candidate couldn't fight back as much if they didn't have the funding to do it. So it gave them an advantage as well and let them control narratives. And so this was kind of a fake and phony issue, but it managed to pass into law. Like when I say fake or phony, here's what I mean, John. If you would have ranked 25 issues at the time in rank importance on any American's ballot, this would have been number 25 in the list, right? And it wasn't saying that people didn't care about it, but in comparison to 24 other things, you know, that's it ranked down at that level. And it passed anyway, and he was, you know, heralded. So we went to work with a group of people to challenge it in a lawsuit. That lawsuit went all the way to Supreme Court. RealCampaignReform.org was the organizing plaintiff, I call us. We were the ones that had initiated the process. This was our new nonprofit for that purpose. We published all of the materials and kept people up to date on what the progress of the lawsuit was. Right. And we were the largest funder of it. Our attorney sacrificed quite a bit to do it, but there were two other primary funders that joined us. I want to mention, too, we had a lead plaintiff. We got automatic standing by having Congressman Ron Paul as our lead plaintiff. And then the other two organizations that joined us in funding were Gun Owners of America and an organization called Citizens United, which eventually would end up having its own landmark decision nearly a decade later.
Right.
That had a dramatic effect on how campaign finance law works today. But we were partners all the way back in 2001 and 2. We lost the two counts that we cared about in the Supreme Court. It was an extraordinary case. Most times the Supreme Court hears all the cases in an hour. This one was a nearly 3-hour affair with lots of different co-plaintiffs making presentations. And at the end of the day, we lost our two counts, 6-3 and 5-4. And but we stayed in the game and we continue to file amicus briefs in this area and others in the years to follow. And as I am able to report, we were even involved tangentially in the with an amicus brief in the Citizens United case, making an argument that helped prevail, helped make the day.
Yeah. And for folks who may not be in deep in politics, they may have just heard, oh, Citizens United was bad. It allows billionaires to control elections. Give me maybe two or three sentences as to why Citizens United was so important and how it aligned with what you were trying to do with RealCampaignReform.org.
So RealCampaignReform.org was a temporary organization. It wasn't around very long. It's kind of a predecessor to what would become Downsides DC. The best way to explain it is that most people don't know what was actually the case in controversy, which was it was about a movie. And that movie had been deemed by the FEC as a movie that could not be, they could not use normal movie distribution methods. It's a publishing issue. It's a broadcast issue, which is why we made a free press argument initially. They were basically saying you can't do things the way you normally would do them if you were trying to produce a movie. These would fall under campaign finance restrictions and you would be prevented from being able to raise the necessary funds to capitalize. The movie could be made, but you couldn't distribute it. You couldn't put it in theaters. You couldn't put it in broadcast channels. You couldn't promote it in any way. You would effectively have all of your fundraising constrained. And so imagine if the New York Times, for example, they weren't allowed to charge, it was $1,000 at the time, more than $1,000 for any ad, like the full page ad in the New York Times, you couldn't charge more than $1,000 for it. Just imagine that. Imagine the local TV station or even the national networks not being able to charge more than $1,000 for one of their slots. They wouldn't be able to maintain their business model, let alone get the audience they need. And so that was the same thing that this movie experienced. And the Supreme Court recognized that that was wrong. Now, the problem with the campaign finance laws is they're designed, number one, to make sure that no pain in the butt challengers get elected. They are designed to protect incumbents, and they're designed to keep the most pesky of challengers, the ones who would shake things up, out. But should one of those people get through, they have ways of getting you ingratiated into their system. If you don't want to play ball, they can use the technicalities in this law to get virtually anybody, and they can throw you in prison, as they did with Steve Stockman and others. So they can use campaign finance laws to create phony scandals to defeat you at the polls or ultimately even put you in prison if you don't want to play ball once you get there. So they're designed to keep people out and to take people who manage to get sneak through to take them out.
Right. So, and I think, you know, when you talk about things, and this is, you know, it pertains to third parties more and more, right? But it also pertains to mavericks within the Republicans or the Democrats, for that matter.
Yes.
But the real pain is for, like, the Libertarians, the Greens, the Communist Party, the Constitution Party, whatever, that first of all, you have all the limitations on funding and speech and all that. Also have the ballot access laws, which are crazy.
Yep.
So, I mean, here in New York, the Libertarians lost ballot access. And I read somewhere, now I don't know how accurate it is, I read in one of these reviews that it's more onerous to get on the ballot if you're a third party in New York than it is to get on the ballot to challenge Putin in Russia. That the New York laws are actually more onerous in terms
just in the last couple of years, I think your state has moved into first place in terms of the level of difficulty. Yeah.
Yeah. And I a lot of times talking with my friend Larry Sharp on this, he's like, hey, I filed lawsuits for some reason. Nothing works. No one can see the disenfranchisement of hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who would otherwise vote for a third party that simply cannot. They cannot vote for their preferred candidate. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's an issue without a doubt, and certainly thanks to folks like you, there's been some attention thrown to it. Do you feel there's been any progress made in this area at all, Jim?
Well, Citizens United was progress, and there's been a couple other decisions like Wisconsin Right to Life and a couple others along the way that have been that have helped open or expand the campaign finance portion of this. Not enough, but it would be possible now to do something that we couldn't do back in the year 2000 when Harry ran. So, you know, one of the great tragedies to me is that Harry Brown was a character out of central casting. I mean, he looked the part, he sounded the part, and when he showed up, he spoke in well-organized sound bites. He used the time that he would have in these 5 and 7 minute interviews, 30 minute interviews. He used it all very efficiently, and he always reminded people to come and join. In 96, it was, he gave out the 800 number. In 2000, the technology changed. He was giving out the web URL. And by doing that, he helped grow the party and he helped make people permanent libertarians like me. But he also messaged this incredibly well and really helped us deliver a fairly radical message in a pretty mainstream way. The problem was we didn't have the money. Right. We didn't have the money to compete. And contributions back then were limited to $1,000 per person per election. So it was nearly impossible to figure out a way to accumulate enough resources. We knew people at the time who believed in him enough. In 1996, they knew, this is before my time, they knew people that he came from the investment world. He was an expert on gold and the collapsing dollar. He'd been a best-selling author in the 1970s, and he was still on the speaking tour in the 90s. He was still revered in a lot of circles. And so he knew some significantly wealthy people who were capable of writing 5, 6, and 7-figure checks to an effort. They would have done it. I'm convinced they would have done it. And that would have put him on the debate stage. I think there was a possibility, 1996 was the last year that this was possible, that somebody could have gotten on the debate stage. And had he gotten on the debate stage, well, then Katie barred the door. What would have happened at that point? He would have been considered viable and interesting, and it would have, you know, caused some tumult at the time. And so I think, you know, that opportunity, campaign finance laws robbed us of that opportunity at that hour.
You're right. And it's interesting how, if taken from that perspective, you can very clearly see that sort of with the hindsight of looking back. Do you feel, so before I continue, let me ask you this. We've talked about you coming to libertarianism. Do you at some point define your libertarianism? Like, do you consider yourself an anarchist? Do you consider yourself an ANCAP, a minarchist, a classical liberal, any one of the 30 flavors that libertarians will always argue about when locked in a room
together? I do have my own flavor. and none of them surprisingly fit that title. There's me being difficult again.
Okay.
I would call myself a post-statist or voluntarist, meaning that I believe that the Declaration of Independence is one of the greatest documents in the history of humanity. We still haven't lived up to it yet. I don't believe that the constitutional republic we were given has lived up to it, but I do believe it was a huge leap forward. But I think there's something better, and that's where we can reach the point that we're all voluntarily interacting. You're a self-governor who sees something and does something, or you're a self-governor who sees something and helps something, or you're a self-governor who says, I'm already busy helping other things. I'm going to mind my own business. And I think that's how the world should work. I think people should be able to voluntarily interact. All of our relationships, including those that regulate us, should be voluntarily selected. And those things should be oriented towards serving the customers that are paying for that service or that have sought out that service. As a post-statist, I would call this consumer-controlled governance. I embrace a philosophy called human respect, which says that anytime theft, violence, or coercion is used against someone, their happiness, harmony, or prosperity declines. And that is an always proposition. It's a principle, meaning that it's like cause and effect. It works a lot like gravity. If I let this pen go, we know consistently it's going to go down. We know consistently that happiness, harmony, and prosperity will decline when someone experiences coercion, theft, or violence. That will just always happen. So, and the math never works out. No matter how we play the game, there's no utilitarian math you could do that overcomes the fact that you have decided to destroy the dreams and the aspirations and the peace that exists between human beings and their ultimate prosperity. Because you have decided that you have a better way that they should live their lives. You're going to take away those choices from them. So I reject this idea completely out of hand. I'm not comfortable with the term anarchist because I neither own a black turtleneck nor have I ever built a bomb. I don't want to be called that. I don't want to be associated with that. But you know, could you still, you know, throw that charge at me? Maybe. I just believe that everybody should be able to live in peace and harmony with one another, and there shouldn't be a state at all to interfere. And I believe I could demonstrate on any issue at any time, if we talk long enough, that we don't need the state. We can do better without it. Like, does it just pick the issue? No matter even the hardest ones, we can do better without the state alternatives that we have, that we can organize better. We can organize more peacefully. We can have greater harmony, social harmony, and better results at the end of the day. I believe across the board, I believe all of that is possible. And I infuse all of this in a show now that I do called Graysarchy.
Yes, I wanted to get to that. I want to give you a chance to talk about Graysarchy.
Okay, but I bring my faith into that as well. So,
okay. Your faith being Christian?
I'm a Christian. And the two things that are that I'm particularly focused or obsessed on are the fact that we are, number one, made in the image of God. That's right at the very beginning of the book. There's something about our humanity. There's something about our male and female side that makes us godlike. That was the plan from the beginning, and that means every human being has value. And the second thing is, I believe that God is Trinity. It's three persons united completely in harmony with one another, and we are being invited into their relationship. And I believe that has significant anthropological value and meaning. I'm also very interested in the philosophy of Rene Girard. I just threw out anthropology, but I believe that there is a sacrificial model that is at the root, maybe you can call it an original murder, that is at the root of every state and every religion. And that at the end of the day, the state needs to constantly shed blood to prove its efficacy and power to the rest of us. It has to show us how omnipotent it is. That's one of the things. I mean, I'm giving you a thumbnail sketch here. Sure. That it has to do. And I arrive at a position where my faith, and I'm not a hyphenated like libertarian Christian libertarian. I believe that, you know, God's basically offered a libertarian, he's built a libertarian world. And I don't mean that in the crass modern political sense. I mean that in the sense that free will is clearly very important in the way that the world works and in the way that God chose to interact with his people and in the arc of the story that's told in the Bible. And so I come away, it's warp and woof to me, my faith and my libertarian values, they go together. It's hard to tell where one starts and the other stops.
Right. It's the totality of that you're looking at. And thank you for that answer. I appreciate.
Thank you. That's probably the fastest I've ever explained that, John. So, you know.
Oh, fair enough. But I got you. Yeah. It's because for me, I always struggle with that because, like, I'm not an anarchist, but my sort of guiding principle is act libertarian in your daily life, as an individual. And then let's worry about the governmental issues and intricacies second. But I think that for most people, if we strive to live as libertarians, again, not in the political sense, but to use your sort of like in the individualist, voluntarist sense, I think that's where the big change comes. And even if it's something as simple as like, I won't bother you if you don't bother me, you know, mm-hmm. it's just respect and love and appreciation for each other. Absolutely. You know, that's that to me, that's whatever that's called. Sign me up for that, you know,
yeah.
So whatever category that falls into. Okay, great. Jim, it's about that part of the conversation where I want to turn to something called silly questions.
Okay.
And these are just five questions. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just a way for folks to get a little bit better understanding of yourself. So, silly question number one.
Okay.
The year is 2070, and the U.S. government finally adopts libertarian policies. What's the first thing that would shock people about this new world?
So it happens abruptly, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It just,
let's just assume one day it's here in 2070.
How little they miss government. So when we've had shutdowns in the past that have lasted for a day or two, you know, they immediately go to the park and they show the barricade there and they say they cut off the parks because all the park employees are gone. And so they're trying to scare you because the park is like the most innocuous part of the government. Nobody's really opposed to the park, right?
Right.
And they use it and they try to shock you with that. But there's a whole bunch of things that the government's doing that are bad. And even when they're trying to help are destructive to people around them. And I think the need for government is grossly exaggerated. And I think people wouldn't miss it very long. And I would, by the way, point to as evidence, I think Donald Trump was not much of a president during his first term. He was waving around doing crazy things. And he was kind of unmasking how ineffective or impotent the office was, which I thought was actually his best attribute during his first term. He was really showing that it was kind of a wizard behind a curtain type of situation. And we found out how little he was.
Not by design, but.
And then Biden turned out to be an even better president in this respect because he just wasn't there.
Right.
And he was working 4 or 5 hours a day. And it turned out that was too much. And so I just think people wouldn't miss it.
Right. Okay. That's a good answer. Number two, which historical figure do you think would have made a great Twitter troll?
I don't know why I'm thinking of Abraham Lincoln right now. I tried to think of like other names even as I'm sitting here talking to you, but I'm thinking of him.
Okay. So
Abraham Lincoln had this practice. He actually was a very powerful writer and speaker, and he knew how to use words. Like, this is one of the all-time wordsmiths. I just thought of a second one too that fits in this exact same category. But what people don't know is that when he died, they found a bunch of letters in a drawer. And these were letters he didn't send. So the way that he would handle people that he felt were particularly vexatious to him is while he was angry, he would sit down and pen an angry note to them. And then he would sit on it. He would put it in a drawer and decide what to do with it. I think he destroyed an overwhelming majority of these letters because they were kind of, people even felt it was a little bit out of his character at the time. But apparently he really knew how to turn a phrase. I would say Winston Churchill, though.
That's the one I was thinking.
Fantastic. Yes. Stories of this same direction of him, you know, with Lady Astor and whatnot, where he, you know, Winston, if you were my husband, I would serve you poison. He said, madam, if I was your husband, I would drink it. You know, so that's, Winston would probably win the award, but for some reason I was thinking of Lincoln's desk drawer.
Yeah. You know, when I write these questions, sometimes it just in case my guest asks me for my response, I try to think of an answer as well. And Winston Churchill was the first one that came to my mind. So we're thinking alike on that one. But it's interesting. I did not know that about Lincoln. It kind of mirrors what I do when I'm angry with people, and I write them an angry email, and then I'll put it in my drafts.
Okay, so word to all the people that know you, the moment John kicks the bucket, rush to the drawer.
Yes.
You're going to find out where you really stood with them all along.
Yeah, my wife knows that as well, so she can figure that out too. Yeah. All right. Has there ever been an argument made against libertarianism, Jim, that actually made you pause for a second?
Yes.
What was that argument?
I don't remember what the proper term is. It's not coming to me in my senior state right now, but it has to do with the fact that there are certain areas that are common and the environment is a commons. And how would we possibly apportion or regulate out people's damage to the environment? Some of these questions are actually relatively easy in this arena are actually relatively easy to solve. But air pollution stands out in particular. Who owns the air? How do you control the air? And increasingly, I think people would put environment in that category. But I think it's under the same heading. I think it has to do with what kind of pollutants you could put out there. And that is a more difficult question to answer.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that was Milton Friedman's concern when it came to libertarianism.
It's the only one that works.
Yeah, he had an example where he said, I think it was on the Donahue appearance where he said, Donahue said, well, what about the particulates coming out of car exhausts? And how do you, and he said that he goes, that may be one of the few legitimate roles for government is to, who would you sue? Who would you take to court? Who would you, like, if I get lung cancer because you've been running an exhaust in my backyard all day, but it's floating in from a different area. How do you apportion blame? How do you recover and things like that? So
yeah, that's a difficult one. And I would say closely related to this, there are no purposes for the federal government. And the only one that is even reasonably defensible is that there is this question of who watches the watchers. And if the federal government's whole role was to keep rogue sheriffs and corrupt state governments, because this was originally kind of a confederation, to make sure that the rights of the people were protected from those actors, well, then I think you could justify the federal government. But you can't justify it on any other ground. You can make a lot of arguments, some of them very interesting and compelling, but in the end, you would lose regardless of what other function you gave the federal government. It just does not work, full stop.
Yeah, I think the only typical ones you hear of are national defense.
National defense is the biggest one, yeah.
Yeah, and then...
courts of final authority or appeal
right.
is another. Those yeah. are some of the pillars, and I actually think those can all be explained.
Right, and to me, that's the... If you get to where you're only... If you're a libertarian and you're getting to the point where those are the only two or three things you're arguing about, I think we're all in a great shape at that point, right?
Yeah, because, I would prefer that there was a predisposition to get to those being the only remaining arguments.
Yes.
But we all know that we don't really have a Department of Defense. If we're being honest with ourselves, we have a Department of Trouble Creation.
Yes.
That causes a lot of trouble, and it's a large... The Pentagon is the world's largest purchasing department. There's a lot of pork and graft running through the place.
Sure.
So, you know, the idea that we need the military that we have is even, I mean, if you're talking about defense, we could do a whole lot better with a whole lot less. Less would be better.
Agreed. 100%. Jim, what's one conspiracy theory you secretly wish was true because it would make the world more interesting? So let's start off with the basic question. Are you generally, would you label yourself a conspiracy theorist in general?
Well, I don't know if I get to, you know, there's a certain point at which you're the definition of you isn't who you think you are, it's what other people think you are.
Well, what other people say then?
So I've just completed, the next one's going to be released next week, my third episode discussing the Kennedy assassination. And I didn't believe in that. I was predisposed to be opposed to that up until late 2022 and did. And now I'm, you know, I fell into the kind of the rabbit hole on this one. I'm generally biased to resist conspiracies. I find that most of them they don't even get past the smell test at the very beginning. But in this particular case, I'm out in the open. I'm on public record here. Wish was true, though. That's the thing that throws me about your question is I don't know what I wish would be true.
Right. Like, so for as a stupid example, you might say like, oh, well, I think flat earth is a conspiracy theory, but it would be fun if the earth was flat type of thing.
I can't think of anything.
Fair enough. If you can't think of anything, you can't think of it.
That's
enough. Yeah. Because sometimes I think what happens is like you'll hear a conspiracy theory. And like you said, the overwhelming majority don't even pass the smell test. Mm-hmm. But one of them, even though it doesn't pass the smell test, you're like, oh, I wish it kind of did so I could dig into it a little more if I had the time.
Yeah, I really did. I've spent a lot of time in the last little more than 2 years now. I have to keep track of this. It's a little more than 2 years, and I've even traveled to investigate this particular one.
The JFK one?
Yeah.
Okay. And finally, the last question, and this is based, I admit, on what I thought was the proper pronunciation of your name, which it's not. It's not Bobka, it's Babka. So this one you'll have to like give me some latitude on.
Nope,
settle the biggest one of the biggest debates among old school New Yorkers. Which Bobka is best, cinnamon or chocolate?
Cinnamon takes a back seat to no man, but chocolate is better. So yes, it's a sweet bread for people that don't know.
Yes.
So my name actually is very closely related to grandma. Mm. So this is a grandma's pastry is basically what it is. But it's a very interesting kind of pastry that usually has some kind of fruit in it, even though it's primarily like a chocolate or cinnamon, there's a fruit and commonly there's a rind, like an orange rind or something in there. And these flavors combine together in a way that's a whole lot of fun. So I had a friend that picked up on this, and I make these regular trips out to in my business to out to California. And when I was out there, Hannah made me a babka by surprise, and she was sending me home with it. So I have the babka, and she wraps it in wax paper and wraps the outside of that in foil and puts a bag on top of that because she had made this and then kind of froze it, and I was going to take it home. And she was trying to package it a certain way. And she told me something before I left that didn't register completely about how I needed to pack this before I left. But I just put it in my carry-on and didn't think anything of it. And when I got through the TSA, of course, they needed to figure out what this object was, this large object in there. And it dawns on me when they're pulling me over why this is happening. Like, that's the first moment I recognized why Hannah had said all the things, you know, that she had said. You know, you remember the penis cartoon and the teacher, like, mop, 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 mop. Right, when right, she right, was right. saying all of it, it was like, I don't, what are you talking about?
Right.
But now all of a sudden, ding, it all collects and it connects. And I pull out my ID real quick. And I show it to the TSA guy. And I said, okay, here's the story. You're about to look. I really don't want you to open this package all the way. You got to do your job, but I don't want you to open this package. Here's why. I explained to him who I was, what was in the package, and had it. You know, it's like Seinfeld says in the episode, you can't beat a babka.
Well, I'm also glad that we've got a Seinfeld lover or someone who at least is familiar with the show enough to pick up on the joke. Jim. Thank you so much for this time that you've been able to give us. Please tell everyone where they can find you on X or any other social media, your podcast.
Grace. I don't have a very big presence on X. I am on Facebook, but I am both places. My podcast, that's the best place to find me. I'm at, it's called Grace Sarkey with Jim Babka. You can look up Jim Babka or Grace Sarkey, either one. It's, you know, put two words together, Grace and Arkey, which is government. So call it Governance by Grace. And so that's my podcast, and I'm still affiliated with DownsizeDC.org. You can come to Agenda Setters by DownsizeDC, and I still work with the Advocates for Self-Government, and we have a project that just launched that I'm involved with called Respect America. I'm and other things, too. I'm fortunate to be able to be involved in a variety of different projects and interact with a lot of interesting people in my present work, but those are some of the primary ones right now.
Fantastic. Jim, thank you so much for joining the Big Questions with Big John. And for everyone else out there, thank you for joining us to watch this episode. Join me again next time, and I'll have yet another interesting guest that we'll have the opportunity to have a conversation with. Until then, this is Big John. Come back here to Grumblings Media for all your informational entertainment needs. Okay, everyone. Peace out. See you next time.